All right, here we go. Are we ready?
Oh, okay. I was not expecting that. Yet.
I guess.
We're definitely not ready.
No.
Welcome to M-Vibes Podcast.
Home of good music.
Good libations.
And good vibes.
Hey, everybody.
Hello.
So Amanda here, back from her. I was rehired because apparently I was fired in the last episode.
Both of you were fired last. You and
Kristen. Yeah. Well, we'll just go start our own business. So this week Eric is fired.
Eric's
or
not
what
here.
Did you say earlier on administrative pay leave?
Without pay.
Yeah. Okay. Wait a minute. Was he getting paid before?
I don't know, but he's getting paid now. I mean, well, yeah. He's at his real job.
Yeah, he is working now.
This is the first time he doesn't join us, right? Or did we do one without him before?
I don't know. We're drunk all the time. Don't ask me to remember things. Speaking of...
No, it's usually Amanda.
Well, yeah, because I have a night job, so...
Yeah.
Don't ask questions. And no, I'm not telling you.
Eric did miss one when he went to a show instead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, he definitely should have gotten fired for that one.
He's fired, rehired, and then fired again. And then he'll be rehired next week. So what's everybody drinking today?
I am drinking Oktoberfest Marzen by Noda Brewing, which it's delicious. It's great.
You got the same?
Yeah, and I actually went with Maker's Mark 46 today instead of Basel, which is what you usually get. Not bad. I've never had it before.
I've got Basel, the usual.
The usual. I have another Marzen Lager, Clawhammer Oktoberfest by Highland Brewing out of Asheville.
It's the season.
Yeah, as I say, we're entering that season. Marzen Lagers.
And I also have some, I don't know what the hell this whiskey is.
You already forgot?
It's out of Heaven Hills, but it's not Heaven Hills. It's Kentucky something. It has a horse on the bottom.
That's what matters.
Kristen's drinking orange juice.
Yes. What are you drinking, Kristen?
It's so hazy.
That mic is live, isn't it?
Is it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is. Live.
Yeah.
That's a scary thought. I shouldn't have a mic.
I mean, we can unplug it at any time.
Yeah. I'm drinking Big Slurp from Noda because, I'm a hazy drinker, even though you guys don't like me like that.
That's okay. That's what he drank yesterday. He had a slurp. I mean, not yesterday, last week.
I think some things are allowed to be slurpy.
Yeah, you know, well.
We don't want an explicit rating on this.
We try to introduce all the Nodon pilot beers here.
Yes.
Nobody has a pilot beer today.
Oh, wow. That's a first.
Is there one in the fridge?
Yeah, there's a bunch.
There's a lot in there.
But we got Highland. We got Highland, and we've never done that.
Yeah, so. I had it last week.
Oh.
If you had been here, Amanda, you would have done that.
Yeah. Sorry, I was busy making money.
Welcome back, being rehired.
Thank you. So today we are going to talk about another one-hit wonder.
Yeah, they're definitely a one-hit wonder, even though they didn't technically hit number one. But I think, it's weird because I'll tell you this before we get started. I knew next to nothing about this band that we're going to talk about. And I despise the thing that I know them for. despise that fucking song. But apparently I knew another song. Once I started listening to all their music, apparently I knew another song by them. But so if I were to ask you who is like the most hardcore anarcho-punk band out there, who would you say, Amanda?
Crass.
The Crass. What if I tell you that it's not? It's fucking Chumbawamba. The most fucking punk band in the world.
I think I'd debate that with you, but I get what you're saying because they lived that life no matter what style of music they were making. And that's pretty fucking hardcore because you can make that music all day long, but if you're not actually living the life, then what's the point?
Yeah, it's a philosophy.
Crass was living the life too.
So yeah, that fucking Chumbawamba, the one hit wonder earworm that MTV played in fucking incessantly through 1997. You can still hear it today, and like, but pretty much every douche bar, every sports event, every junior prom and spin class, like that fucking Chumbawamba are one of the hardest and most anarchistic punk bands ever, even though they sound nothing like classic, like punk should sound.
I can hear it in my head right now.
Yeah. Well, pissing the net away. That's hardcore.
That's how I spent my whole weekend.
We'll talk about that at the end. So yeah, we're going to talk about Chumbawamba because actually, and again, I did a lot of research and I mean, this rabbit hole goes deep. I mean, really deep. I knew that they kind of had very anarchistic views, but I never bothered to research them. You know, I just heard things. But you know, we'll go through sort of the more factual information before we kind of go into the details. So they actually started out as a high school band in Burnley, Lancashire, England. And it goes back to my whole, pretty much every freaking band we've been discussing lately seems to have ties back to England. So well, maybe we'll keep that one for.
And Burnley.
And no, that's the first time we talked about Burnley.
No, we talked about Burnley before too.
Bristol. Not Burnley.
And Bristol. And Manchester. And Liverpool?
Just got a message from Birmingham. Eric. Says, I'll be late.
Tell him he'll be right on time for karaoke.
So, yeah, they started as a high school band in the late 70s. They were called Chimp Eats Banana. I know the original members were Alan Whaley, who now goes by Boff, Denver Novakon, who is a pretty hardcore motherfucker. Interestingly, one of the things I read, the way they met is when Boff was kind of going to meet some friends and was walking down the street, he just randomly stumbled upon Danbird wearing a straitjacket for no reason, and they just started a conversation and they became friends and legend musicians now. Yeah, apparently he was just standing out there with a straitjacket on. Other members were Midge and Tommy. Under that band, they really only released one cassette album titled The Cardboard Box. You can actually find most of that album on YouTube, and it's pretty interesting. Their sound back then was a lot more on the more wacky but very traditional punk sounding, similar to hardcore punks of the time. And they have no real political sort of affiliation then. They were just a band. They sounded a lot like the Crass, really, because around 1982, when they kind of were in college, they decided to form another band. But this is sort of their original sound.
So this is Crass.
This is the Crass. This is not Chumbawamba.
So this band was their heroes when they first started out. They really wanted to emulate them and really looked up to their politics and what they were doing.
Yeah, a lot of their anarchistic views came from the Crass, and actually from watching the Sex Pistols perform, but also because one of the things that we were discussing when we talked about doing this episode is that are these, like, they come from rich backgrounds, but none of them did. They actually come from very blue-collar, middle-class, you know, kind of barely making by families. So a lot of their anarchistic views they took from the Crass and their own personal lives. That, you know, in tandem with, at that time, Margaret Thatcher taking the Brits to war against Argentina over some fucking islands, it just really turned them, or made them aware of the political environment of the time and sort of how disenfranchised they felt about it. So, you know, I'll tie it all in together, and that pretty much created Chumbawamba as we don't know it today, because I didn't know how hardcore these guys went. I thought they were just a bunch of pretty boys, but they're not. So then during this time, when they first started out, I mean, because of their views and very, very, very leftist views, obviously very radical leftist views, they played a lot in like squat camps and peace camps in the area. And they were primarily raising money or goods or whatever to benefit those that were affected.
And they kind of dabbled a little bit getting into some more like folk. Mm-hmm. Sounding stuff too. Didn't they do a whole album that was just like folk songs through history?
Yeah, that was later on. They released an album later on. I think it was late 80s, I want to say, maybe mid 80s.
But still
pre-hit single. Absolutely. It was a third album, I believe, and it was called English songs, something or other from 1813 to 1984. And the concept was that they released all these, it was completely a cappella, and it only featured protest songs. That's what it was. What's what it was? English protest songs. And it was all a cappella. And one of the earliest songs that they covered, you know, dated back to the 1800s. So in regards to the name, though, throughout the years, they gave a bunch of different stories regarding kind of the name Chumbawamba. And people had their own theories of what it was. Some theories, or one of the biggest ones that I read that found interesting was that during a dream, Danbird couldn't differentiate between a man and a woman's bathroom. So Chumbawamba was a term that came to him. That was bullshit, but that was interesting. other theories were that a monkey typed it on a typewriter, and that is the name of some sort of obscure mascot. Obviously, all these are not true.
Well, I think I'd heard a story about that they had heard like they're like some street musicians that were like African in origin, and they were just doing this chant while they were drumming, and the chant sounded like like a chumba bumba bumba, and it was like nonsensical, and they just kind of derived their name from that.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Okay.
Pretty much in an interview, Boff himself quoted, "While we were busking in Paris, there were a bunch of North African drummers used to come bus near them. And when they started, you couldn't hear yourself think, apparently, right? They were fantastic," what he said, "but they used to sing Chum Chum Bawailin or Chum Chum Bawailin. I didn't hear it. I read it, so I don't know what it would actually sound like." He said it was great rhyming, and they thought that they could just call themselves Chumbawailin because it doesn't mean anything and was open-ended. And then eventually that got sort of bastardized into Chumbawamba.
I feel like that's probably the most realistic story. It's,
right. Well, that he quoted that. Like he okay, that's what so he that, said. Okay, yeah, okay, that gotcha, is the actual gotcha, story.
Gotcha.
I didn't know. I guess I never really thought about it, but the name seemed to make more sense for what they actually became famous for than a hardcore punk band, which I guess even speaks more to, you know, most hardcore anarcho punk bands of the time had very like hard names, right? Like the Clash,
Rudimentary, Flux of Pink Indians,
right
Conflict, exactly. Subhumans,
Crass, so you know, kind of they chose Chumbawamba. So you know, shortly after they came back from Paris, they added more members, including Lou Watts, Dunstan Bruce, and Alice Nutter. That's not a real name. I didn't actually write it down, but that's not a real name. But she went on to be, you know, one of the iconic members, just like the other two. So they're the three most commonly known members. There's been a bunch of rotating members throughout their existence.
And that's like the same thing with all those bands coming out time period. You go to like their Wikipedia pages, they only have like 30 members.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's still happening today.
What is?
That's what we were talking about last week. It's like every band or artist we speak to, it's just a revolving door of people coming through. Mm-hmm.
There's a your mom joke there somewhere.
Your mama,
your daddy, your greasy granny. Okay, I'm done. I'm sorry.
Oh god,
forgive me, continue.
This concludes our off the rail moment in Invise podcast.
You mean the first off
the first of the night. So now under Chumbawamba, they released their first track on the second edition of the now legendary Bullshit Detector LP, released by Crass Records, which was obviously owned by the band Crass as well. So I couldn't really find any of this music on Spotify, which is sort of where we typically stream from. But there's a very raw version of it on YouTube and definitely worth the listen. Again, very much like, you know, they sounded completely different than what that one song that we're all used to. It was more of a noise punk with a very, you know, very low production quality. And just this constant guitar hiss or hum that couldn't quite play. That just really added to like the whole hardcore vibe that they had going on at the time. Why are you shaking your head?
That would drive me nuts.
Oh, I loved it.
I'd be trying to get rid of that.
I mean, obviously it made sense for them to, you know, release the album, their first album, a compilation, with fellow anarcho punks, Crass. Well, they were actually influenced by bands like The Fail, Public Image Limited. Why can't I say that? And Adam and the Ants. Their sound
Mephiscopheles. Oh, damn it. Eric's not here.
No. There was another word somebody couldn't pronounce last week. Can't remember what it was, though. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, they were influenced by those kind of post-punk bands.
Cool story, bro.
Tell it again.
But again, like I said, the sounds is really nothing like traditional punk or post-punk of the era. They took a lot of influences from, you know, obviously punk, because that's what they were, but also from folk, which you can hear all the way through the late 90s albums, dance music, and pop music, which obviously is what we know them more for. But those influences have been around since the early 80s. It's not something they just randomly picked up in the 90s.
Well, and I might be jumping ahead a little bit on this too, but weren't they like, they really were starting to get influenced by rave culture?
Yes. I was in the late 80s.
They were using a lot of samples, but it was more like they were sampling like Margaret Thatcher talking about how great cops are and stuff like that. It wasn't like traditional like techno music stuff that they were doing, but they were influenced by that, you taking that style and making it into something that was more political.
Yeah, and this is more towards the late 80s, but yeah, they were one of the first few acts that actually started blending and integrating sort of electronic pop music and rock and roll with some spoken word, and like you said, sort of like a cold openings from pre-recorded political issues, like from Margaret Thatcher.
Beautiful woman.
Okay.
Wow,
and that's our show for tonight, fella.
So is Ernest fired now?
It's about principalities, Melky. But yeah, that was later on. That's actually that's what ultimately eventually led to like the dumping song. Yeah. Because they were one of the first bands that actually started experimenting with those, which went well in the UK, by the way. But here in the States, we were like, no, fuck it. Like, that's disco. Like, we hate you. Yeah. It was weird.
Well, I don't think they were disco enough at that time to get popular in the United States. Because they still weren't sounding like Donna Summer, you know?
No. And again, this was the late 80s. I mean, disco was fucking dead by that point.
Oh, yeah. Late 80s?
Yeah. This was
it was definitely dead by then.
Yeah.
Thank God.
So yeah, anyway, going back, I mean, at the time, you know, they already had kind of, you know, espoused themselves to their hardcore political views, and, you know, they would mostly, you know, scream in their songs about animal rights, gender equality, and capitalism. They're also very
feminism,
and
feminism.
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, pretty much. Yeah. I mean,
all the isms.
They're also very active in demonstrations and, you know, other direct actions that they supported the views that they espouse, right? So from here on out, I mean, that was sort of their what do they call it, the Wikipedia data that you know, that's more of the factual thing. But from here, the mid 80s, which is the things we're gonna kind of touch on here, is what makes them, to me, in my opinion, one of the hardest, most anarchistic bands out there. The mid 80s seems to have been like their high point of rebellion, of kind of pushing the envelope and doing things. And it sort of culminated in the late 90s after they went mainstream. So we're talking about a little bit kind of like the things that are more, some of the more hardcore things that they did. And then a lot of, you know, sort of their albums and you know, what their albums.
Well, and this is kind of when they started like talking trash about Live Aid and Bob Geldof. What was the name of the album?
There was Dead Children's Pictures Sell Records. Yeah. So shortly before that, well, the first actual big thing they did as a group that hit sort of more mainstream news, it was in the early 80s, more like the mid 84, I want to say. They kind of came to terms with the fact that they weren't very good activists themselves, but they were really good at supporting other activists, which is kind of allowing them and giving them platforms to speak and kind of widely spread their message. So with that mindset, they jumped right into the UK miners' strike in 84 or 85, I can't remember. And actually, yeah, it is, because I did have a note of it. In 1985, in the UK government closed 20 collieries. I never heard this word, collieries, which is what we call coal mines, terminating 20,000 jobs. This, you know, obviously had a huge impact on them, as they believed that working, like going to work and having a job to earn your living, was inherently wrong. So they never had done it before. They just sort of lived their lives by being artistic and creative, and that's what they believed in. But at this
point, so the government owned the mines, or
they did.
So if you were a coal miner, you were working for the government.
They were working for a bureau. Yeah, it was like a coal miner, bureau of coal or something like that. Or yeah,
that's what happens when you claim a natural resource.
Yes, it is actually. They have a lot of songs about governments profiting from resources, which is, I mean, the UK was not the only one at the time.
Destroy the state I'm from.
Destroy the country I'm from. So like I said, they kind of changed their point of view about, you know, people who work are stupid, and, you know, they're like, oh, wait, whoa, this is the government fucking these people up who are like actually trying to do good and make a living and earn money for the family. So they got very involved in that. And that was, I mean, there was nothing particularly controversial about that, just they were very vocal and open about their involvement in that movement. But then right, like immediately after, they were about to release their first album. This was in mid 1985. And that's when like the rumblings of that massive Live Aid quote unquote benefit concert was announced as a single concert that would be played in two cities, Philly and Liverpool, I want to say.
I think so. Yeah. That sounds right. I mean, I'm sure somebody will let us know for
But I know Philly was one of them. The concert was billed as raising, you know, awareness and financial support to fight famine in Ethiopia. You know, anybody who was anybody at that point was billed to perform. Paul McCartney, Queen, U2, Led Zeppelin.
Phil Collins.
Well, he was playing drums for Led Zeppelin.
Oh.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. In that concert he did. I don't know.
It was kind of like a huge thing in the 80s too. It was all these like benefit concerts, you know, like Live Aid, Farm Aid.
We Are the World.
We Are the World. And then They Know It's Christmas USA Time?
For Africa.
Africa. Yeah. Which I'm sure turned out Chumbawamba was probably correct. It probably was very profitable for a lot of people, but a lot of those funds did go where. So I don't know if it's necessarily totally a bad thing. It probably made people a lot more aware of some stuff that was going on in the world they would not have known about if there wasn't Phil Collins playing drums for Led Zeppelin.
Well, I mean, you know, there's been some exposés about Live Aid and Farm Aid and how much money actually went to what they were raising.
That sounds juicy.
Yeah. From what I heard is like less than 25%.
The point of contention for them was that the benefit concert itself cost millions of dollars to put together. Why not just give that money to the charity you're supporting? Why even go through the trouble of putting together this fucking act when you can just take all those millions of dollars and donate that?
That was another argument back then was bands were wanting to be paid.
And all these bands that were playing these benefit concerts could all afford to send $1 million each to these foundations not even had the concert.
That's what a lot of people thought. It's just a big farce.
It's a money grab. A farce.
And that's the issue they took up. They took on it. They believe that mixing the sort of the star culture, right, and the inequality of the world without politics was just insincere and wrong. And that if you have a concert about world hunger, then you fly Phil Collins halfway across the fucking world, and you obviously do not understand the politics of world hunger or any charitable act, really, right?
It's like the story about Bono. You know, with he's playing some concert and he was like refusing to perform without his hat. So he sends a jet back to Ireland to get his favorite hat or his sunglasses or some bullshit like that. So they fly a jet plane round trip to bring him a clothing accessory, but he's an environmentalist.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, sorry.
She flew Phil Collins to Ethiopia.
without his drumsticks and then fly the plane back to get drumsticks and then back to Ethiopia.
Or just roast him over a spit. Feed the whole village.
I like Phil's.
Sorry. He's no Peter Gabriel.
No. But Peter Gabriel didn't do The Lion King. And that thing is.
You had to. Sorry. Done.
So, as a result of all this, they already had their first album, like, written, ready to go, and whatever. They fucking, like, trashed the whole album and changed everything about it to reflect their discontent over Live Aid.
That's punk as fuck.
Exactly. They reworked all the songs. I mean, they didn't, like, scrap them. They just reworked the songs for the most part. So into what is now known as what we were talking about earlier, Amanda, Pictures of Starving Children Sell Records.
1, 2, 3, 4.
So this one is called Dutiful Servants and Political Masters, which actually talks about, obviously, colorism, racism, and white supremacy.
Things were rather different in great-grandfather's day. He just put a chain around their ankles and made them work for no pay.
So I will tell you this. I heard this entire album from beginning to end. It's really fucking good.
Like, I'm really digging this.
It's really
good. This is really good.
And most of it has a similar vibe. Unfortunately, I've listened to other albums, and this is the only one that I like. But it's really good.
Yeah, some of the stuff I was kind of listening to their earlier between the hit songs albums, and I was like, I like the lyrics, I like what they're saying, but musically it just wasn't for me.
So, yeah, one of the first things I did, because I told you I didn't know much about them, was, you know, when you go to Spotify, you just hit play artists and it plays the more popular songs. It played Tough Thumping 3 times in a row, so I had to skip it twice. And I just played some other stuff, and I was like, this all sucks. Like, it's musically, it's not for me. I love what they do for their, you know, politics. I mean, obviously they align with mine, so that makes sense. But musically, they do nothing for me.
This almost has a little bit of a Citizen Fish kind of vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is about a minute 30 in. They go haywire, and then she comes in.
See, there you can hear Crass all over this.
So this album, I'm gonna find, because I love every song.
This is giving me so much life right now. I'm like stomping my feet on the ground on the table.
This
so
is the
good.
Same band who sang "Kissing the Night Away." Okay, let's just keep that in mind. They're good. I don't know why they chose to do that.
I have a theory, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, when we get there. So, I mean, the sound of this album focuses on more folky, punky sound and dynamic, you know, vocal harmonies than anything else. But still nothing to do with the sound that we know them for today. That was great, right?
Still, like, that's
that was fucking good.
I got goosebumps over here. It was amazing.
So that's a Chumbawamba album. And again, it's all good. It's all of it. It's fucking good. It's
beautiful.
So you know, once I do the research, I also read a lot of like album reviews, both by critics and by, you know, but just the general public. And one of the album reviews that I read that really stuck out compared this entire album to Black Flag's The Process of Weeding Out. And falls more in their words, is the reviewer's word, in punker than punk, which I completely agree, because it's not really a punk album. It's just their approach, their philosophy, their lifestyle, and their don't give a fuck attitude, because they don't hold back on their lyrics. I mean, they're very like on the nose.
Well, punk is a lifestyle.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know, people will say Blink-182 is punk. That's not punk.
No.
Chumbawamba is more punk than Blink-182 all day long.
I saw a video with a gentleman who spent 20 minutes on a YouTube video begging the question, who is more punk, the Sex Pistols or Chumbawamba?
Chumbawamba
blew them right out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right out of the water. Jamie and I, last week when we went to Pilot to do the commercial, had a very colorful conversation about the Sex Pistols, because he loves them and I fucking hate them. And he had a lot of valid points, but I was not about to get into that conversation.
It was very spirited.
Were you there?
You were there.
Right?
Yeah, I was
it
there.
Because we were witnessing
the birth of a star.
It was.
Yes. Oh, God.
It was very heartfelt. It was very heartfelt. I didn't agree with a lot of it, but it was very heartfelt. And obviously, I wasn't going to.
I think I'm kind of coming around to the fact that I don't really hate the Sex Pistols, but I really hate Malcolm McLaren.
It's another episode because I could ramble for 4 hours on that topic.
Okay. All right. We'll just shut it down. Yeah. We'll just shut it down.
So obviously the themes in this album, and it's kind of like they're constant really, include the irony of Live Aid, which was the main focus. They reworked the whole album to kind of reflect this, the media, colonialism in the UK, but all over the world as well. And then what we discussed earlier, the exploitation of resources by profiteering companies and governments, and the ever popular need to overthrow the capitalist system, which obviously that's always popular. The next album was called Nevermind the Ballots, which focused on attacking the contemporary demographic process, which they argued was rigged and designed to fool the working class into thinking they had a voice, which I mean, that
sounds slightly familiar. Today.
Like still, that's still the thing. We're still living through that, Chumbawamba. Thank you. But I mean, they were woke before woke was a term. So I really, again, I mean, I know I'm fairly far gone on the left. So yeah, I definitely love to, you know, agree with their politics. And no, that's not going to be everyone. But for me, I agree with it. So then this is the one that I wish Eric was here for the next little blurb that I found, which I did not know this. I had no idea that this happened. But also in 1985. The Clash, who by this point had lost a lot of street cred in the punk scene, because you know they were signed to a major label, and you know,
they were hyper aware of it. They knew it. That's why they stopped recording as the Clash.
Yeah, what, 5 albums in 5 years or something like that.
Yeah.
So at this point, they were kind of trying to regain those roots. So they were busking in Leeds. The Clash was, because again, by this time they were just trying to kind of get back in the good graces of punk and. Assigned to CBS Records. This busking session was their, you know, sort of their first attempt. At this point, Chumbawamba were pretty hardcore anarcho-punks. They really hadn't become like the Chumbawamba that we know today. And so this is a pretty much a slap in the face, even though they eventually went on to sign up to a major label themselves. So ironic and, you know, whatever. So they took matters into their own hands and splatter paint all over the Clash while they were performing on that busking show. It was red paint. They covered them in red paint. The red paint was supposed to reference a false rumor that CBS Records was somehow involved in producing cruise missiles. And, you know, by proxy, that means that they were funding possible nuclear holocaust. So obviously that was wrong information. That was not true. None of it was true. So now when, you know, interviews and heard interviews further on where, you know, now that they look back on it, they're like,
probably shouldn't have done that. Sorry.
We were kids.
We were dumb. Like, we didn't have the internet. Have research.
I'm sorry.
Right.
So No.
Here's the thing. This is one of the things that they did not fucking apologize. They will never apologize.
Well, that's punk for you.
Yeah, exactly. For the third album, that's the one we were talking about earlier, it's fully a cappella, only contained covers of English protest songs. They named the album English Rebel Songs 1381 to 1984, which I heard the album. It sounds exactly what you think it was going to sound like. And, you know, like Forrest Gump, that's all I have to say about that. It's just a song of a cappella protest songs. And I think I got through like 3 of them. Then I was like, okay, I'm done. What is happening over there?
I'm just looking at this beer. I'll talk about it on the mic.
She's going to talk about it later.
We're going to talk about it later.
It's unfiltered.
So they're known for switching sounds radically between albums. You know, they went from like the punkish sound to the folk sound to eventually doing an a cappella album of protest song, English protest songs. And for the next...
From what I understand, they did that intentionally because they wanted people to know that not all protest music sounded like punk rock, mm-hmm. that it could sound like folk or reggae or whatever. It's like it just It was an intentional decision.
Or hooligan chants.
One of the reasons why I never...
Gregorian.
You know, and I think this is why I kind of felt, as I went down this rabbit hole, I kind of felt a certain level of connection, because one of the reasons why I never wore the punk uniform is because I felt that that would solely pigeonhole me into the music, not my entire philosophy of what I believed punk was supposed to be. I feel like they fall squarely into that category as well. You know, they eventually, kind of like I do now, I mean, they eventually bought into the system because I have a corporate job, and, you know, but I get to do a lot more damage in there than I can do outside of it. So, you know, to me, I kind of feel a parallel, because I understand why they never wanted to look like a punk, because I didn't want to be pigeonholed as such, because my breath went much wider than that. I think theirs did too, right? So I kind of feel that connection with them for that reason.
And I mean, this was, they were doing this pre-era, what I'm talking about. When we got to be in the 90s, you could go to the mall and buy your punk rock starter kit at Hot Topic, and anybody could walk around looking like that. And it didn't mean that you were actually living that life. You were living in your parents' home in the suburbs, and you're preparing to go to college just like the kids who are playing football, but you were wearing your Doc Martens and your battle vest and your Sex Pistols t-shirt and all that stuff, because you got it on your dad's credit card at the mall.
Or if you were the Sex Pistols, you could just go to Malcolm's Sex Store and do the same thing. Shots. I would never not miss an opportunity to talk shit about the Sex Pistols. So for the next two albums, they again kind of kept switching their sound, and again going back to what we were talking about earlier, Amanda, fusing dance and rock, which was pretty unique and avant-garde for the time. Released two more albums with that sound. I tried listening to them. That's all I'm gonna say. I tried listening to them. I just, that's not my thing. Could not get through them really. But the themes, the subject matter was still there, right? The abrasive approach to their views was still there.
The lyrics were still on point with all their idealism, even though the music didn't sound that way anymore.
Right. So again, at this time, it goes back to what we're talking about. It because of the poppy air sound, people here in the States did not take very well to it. We're in the UK. That sort of sound, which eventually became like Euro electro dance EDM type stuff, they were more into that stuff. So very much more well received over there than they did here. You know, here they were compared to disco and Michael Jackson, even though disco was long dead by this point. This one's going to be Homophobia out of their album Anarchy.
This time, not one nation against others.
That's not, they did a lot of that, but we just mentioned earlier, they just kind of interlaid a lot of pre-recorded sound bits.
Up behind the bus stop in the toilets of the street, there are traces of a killing on the floor beneath.
See, this just sounds like an Irish ballad.
Irish music, yeah.
And beer, our blood stains on the floor.
Her voice
from
is beautiful.
The boy who got his head kicked in a night or two before. Homophobia.
Yeah, that's Alice Nutter.
You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia.
You're so proud of that glass.
You can't love who you want to love in times like these. In the pubs, clubs, and burger bars.
So in 1994, they released this album, Anarchy, which was mostly met with lukewarm reception, but still very successful. One of the interesting bits I read is that every album they released was more successful than the previous one until the one right before Tough Thumping. So again, it was met with some lukewarm reception from both fans and critics, but caused a lot of controversy for the cover, which depicted a baby's head coming out of a vagina. This led some bands and some local stores. There was no major bands, but they were not like a major band. So the bands were mainly some stores. A lot of records were released in plain white sleeves instead of the actual cover art, kind of like Jane's Addiction's Ritual, the Little Habitual type stuff. And even today, when I was looking at through Spotify and iTunes, they've actually replaced the original image with just a bunch of flowers. So
yeah, that's the image I can see on
the phone. Yeah,
on his phone right now.
So that's not the cover album image. It's literally a babysitter poking out of a vagina. The decision to feature the image, though, was their sort of interpretation of questioning obscenity and reality, right? Like, that's reality. That's an issue thing. Why would that be considered obscene, right? So that's why they did it.
I don't know. I think this song's pretty beautiful, actually. It's very sad. The first time I listened to it, I was kind of like, meh. But for some reason right now, it hit different.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the drastic change in sound from what we played originally, which is not really them, the Crash, but that's how they what they sounded like. Then the second song that we played that sort of had a combination of folk and then kind of went into a little more harder punk. And then this, which just completely left the whole punk thing behind. And was just the frame of mind that was punk. They released two more albums throughout the 90s. Again, stuff that I tried to listen to and I just couldn't. They switched sounds and just kind of casted a wider net of social issues that they believe in throughout these two albums. But by the time the mid-90s came around, that last album just wasn't as successful as every previous album, as I mentioned earlier. So they had to do something or kind of, you know, stop doing it. So that's where 1997's Tub Thumping came around. That fucking song. It's you know, everybody knows it. If you don't know it, you're about to listen to it here in a couple minutes. If you don't know it, you must have been living under a fucking rock.
Or you're 16.
Or yeah.
No, I think even 16-year-olds know this.
They should. I mean, it's sugary fucking mess of pop, still drunken, walk of shame of a song.
I don't give a shit. This song is a fucking banger. I like it. I went through many years of hating this song because you could not escape it.
I fucking hate it.
It was like MTV, VH1, Top 40 radio all the time for like a solid year. You just like could not go anywhere without hearing this fucking song.
I was in college in 97 and it was like, fuck this. I'm going to kill somebody.
No, but I didn't listen to this song for many, many years and listened to it again after we were talking about doing this episode. And I was like, this is a banger. This song slaps and I'm happy.
It's a stadium anthem.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a downtown douchebag stadium anthem.
I'm not ashamed.
It shouldn't be.
You say it should be?
And the baby is back on the album cover.
Was it not?
I wonder if it was the same baby. No, he's talking about the baby from the vagina.
Oh, yeah. Did that? Yeah. Maybe that's baby. Why he's got a big smile on his face.
But in their defense, they didn't really do it purposely. On the surface, the lyrics seem to be nothing more than, you know, not really layered or really any deeper than like the Thong Song or Crazy Bitch, which is fucking another song I hate.
Oh, God, I hate that song.
And the music is just boisterous trumpets, annoying guitars and techno beats. But in other words, it was just like a dumb, catchy song about drinking.
But it's not.
But it's not. But it's not. You're right.
But you go ahead with that backstory.
I was waiting for it to kick in.
Oh, okay.
That's that low.
This is the intro.
Most of their songs have like a weird intro.
Yeah, I think they cut this off for like radio airplay. It's just on the album.
But does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
Yeah.
I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down.
Again, her voice. I think she, I don't. I should. I honestly did not research. She has. I know two of them have released solo stuff. I don't know if she released anything on her own because she should. She has a. She has
pipes
on her.
Clear as a bell.
Yeah. So, obviously, they claim that the success of the song was a complete accident and as much a shock to them I said this to anybody who has listened to any of her previous music. I'll wait for this fucking thing to end. It is so contagious, though. It's an earworm. Like, you'll never get it out of your head.
I'm going to hear this and repeat in my head for the rest of the week. I'm going to have to listen to something else that's the worst earworm.
So this morning, I was kind of listening to everything again because I just obsess over what we do. So I saw my daughter walking out of her bedroom and she was skipping and dancing to the fucking song. She's 19. She was born in 2002. So how she knows this song or why, I have no idea. But she knew every one of the three words in the song.
That's awesome. So what tell us about the actual origin, the meaning behind the lyrics.
Yeah. So again, they claim that it was complete shock. But also, like I said earlier, the album that previously released to this one, which don't ask me because I researched it, but that was as relevant as it was, did not meet the expectations of what they were used to. You know, every album prior to that had been more successful than the previous one. So they were used to that. And then the last one just didn't do it. And they kind of started freaking out a little bit. You know, their claim was like, look, we hadn't really found success in almost 15 years. Not that we were really looking for it, but this was also kind of our do or die moment. Like, we were at that point where, like, all right, we've been doing this for 15 fucking years. Like, it's fun and all, but we're getting older, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the anarcho-punk roots took over immediately once they realized the success that they had. Instead of selling out, they decided to use it to their advantage. They felt that they really had inadvertently infiltrated the mainstream and they can use it to spread their message further, that anarchistic leftist.
I do. I feel like it was an intentional move.
They claim it wasn't, but they claim that they used it to their advantage. So they claim that they did it the way they did everything else without the expectation of nothing else, right? No other change that they had done before would radically change their music. They weren't really expecting them to become number, you know, one hit wonders or anything. I don't know who that was either.
That was Neil.
So, you know, the original song was more of an homage to the working class. You know, you're in your shitty job for 40 hours a week or whatever it is in England. And then
what about the drunk neighbor?
Oh, I don't know about that. That's
they had this house and there was this guy who lived next door. He was this working class dude and he would come home just totally drunk every night. He'd always fall down in the yard and drop his keys and his wife would be like, get up, get in the house. And he would do it every single night. And he worked this blue collar job. It's kind of they were talking about him going out and getting shit faced every night and come stumbling home drunk. And it's like, I get knocked down and I get up again because he just kept trudging on. And he was so downtrodden by his terrible job with probably crappy pay and no benefits, and that he would just go to the pub and that was his source of happiness.
The version I read, that makes sense though. But the version I
guess it does.
Yeah. The version
we don't relate to that at all. No. So, I mean, I do love my job, but
I relate to that.
But I still would like to go to the pub.
Yeah. That's where we are right now.
We're at the pub.
We're at the pub.
The pub.
The Tommy's Pub.
Yeah, the
home of Malort.
Oh shit.
It's gone. They got one bottle.
Oh,
they
sold please out don't of it get yesterday. Me started on that shit.
They're getting more. They're getting more.
I've never tried it. I've always wanted to regret
it. Tastes like grassy gasoline. It's sure fucking it delicious.
What the fuck?
Tastes like a rubber band.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Anyway, the
that concludes our off the rails episode two.
Three, actually.
That was three.
I'm sorry. I lost count. I actually did not read or
the couple of interviews that I actually heard or saw on YouTube, they claim, but again, I mean, you have to remember a lot of musicians and bands do shit like that. And you know, they have a purpose and then as the media or the art becomes bigger, they sort of change
the money.
Right. Exactly.
But we're going to get to what they did with that money.
I'm glad you're going to, because I couldn't find a whole lot on that.
Well,
Well, hold on.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Go ahead.
So what I heard was that it was just, again, an ode to the working class. This is what we do, right? We are the working class. We go to the fucking bar. We probably drink more than we should. And then we just go back and do it all over again because, I don't know, we're not Chumbawamba, right? Like, we don't have those. We don't have, like, influencer lives or anything like that, right?
Well,
we're
the blue collar people. The place you go where you see all the familiar faces, the people you know. The cheers. Yeah.
What even the title of the song, Tub Thumping, which I did not know this, and I don't even know how true this is, but apparently it's a reference to aggressive political protest.
And from what I understand, tub thumping is kind of the equivalent, like the English equivalent to soapbox.
Like, how about filibuster?
I don't know. Jamie got on a soapbox about the Sex Pistols last week, not on a filibuster. That makes more sense. He was tub thumping about the Sex Pistols.
That would be a really good, like, punk rock stage name. Phil A. Buster.
So this song,
this could be my drag king name.
So this
Phil A. Buster
became sort of their Trojan horse to spread their leftist message to the masses. That's ultimately how they used it. Now, I can tell you this. I don't know shit about their music after this song either. Okay, the intern's giving us some info. Newsflash.
All right. Kristen for the win. Dictionary definition for tub thumping. Expressing opinions in a loud and violent or dramatic manner. So how I live my entire life.
How I yell at Eric.
I am
Javier's drunken state.
I am officially a tub thumper.
So, big all ass, right. So what did they do thumper. With the money?
Welcome to Tub Thumping Radio.
Ooh, that would have been a great name.
When I was researching this, I found a guy who did an entire podcast, like multi-episode podcast, just on Chumbawamba.
I wish I could say I wanted to listen to that.
Mm.
Actually, you know what? I will tell you this. Am I a fan of Chumbawamba now? No. Am I a fan of that one album? Absolutely. Am I going to continue going down that rabbit hole? Yeah, they're still doing shit to this day.
Didn't they stop in, 2012?
We'll go through that. But I mean, like, personally, in their own personal lives, they're still being radical. So what did they do with the money, Amanda? Tell us.
Okay, so they signed with, EMI? EMI.
Yeah, EMI.
And they defended that by saying their original record label was also just money profiting whores. So they
were just not good at it.
Right. Yeah. So they took the EMI money and ended up donating it back to like some other anarchist organization in the UK that was using the money to take down GM for all their terrible environmental practices.
Yeah.
So they got that cash grab, but then they used it to put it back into something they actually believed in politically. I'm sure they kept enough for themselves to live.
33% is typically the norm.
Yeah, semi-comfortably.
Political donation.
They stood right by their values in the long run.
Yeah.
It's tax deductible.
One of the reasons why I said...
You're so cynical.
One of the reasons why I said that they sort of used this as their Trojan horse to spread their leftist views is because after this you know, the song became massive, and I honestly, again, despised it so much that I didn't even keep track of what they were doing after that. But for example, in 1997, this is a very, very problematic comment statement, even for me, they publicly stated that they liked it when cops were killed. I mean, I have my own problem with our current police force, but that's a little extreme even for me. Then when they performed in the Letterman show, they changed the lyrics to Tub Thumping to say free Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was a prisoner or a political prisoner accused of murder. But most famously, as a result of this becoming massive, in 1998, during the Brit Awards, they went in there supporting the Liverpool Dock Workers Union. They also decided to make a statement by dousing the then Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, with a bucket of cold ice water in the middle of the fucking award show, which was, I mean, they succeeded.
They gave him the ALS challenge.
Yeah.
Maybe they thought he needed to chill out.
So Novacon himself actually ran to Prescott literally with the bucket, literally screaming, "This is for the Liverpool Dockers," and he just fucking dumped that bucket on him. At the time, John Prescott was a member of the Conservative Labour Party, and Chumbawamba had been at odds with the leader of the party, which we all know now, Tony Blair, because he was trying to boycott the Brit Awards due to Chumbawamba's appearance.
Bless his heart.
They were so politically anti-Labour Party, obviously them being leftist, Labour Party being more on the right. They initially got away from you know, they ran out and they got away. Eventually, they kind of were caught up with, and then they, you know, peacefully surrendered and they were taken to the cops. Prescott decided not to press charges, which actually gave him a lot of street cred, and said, somebody told, I can't remember who it was, but somebody told Prescott, I said, look, if you make a big deal out of this and you walk away and you leave, they win. If you stay here soaked as fuck, then you are okay with it. Like you're cool. Like that's, so he decided
literally
to stay. Like you decided, so he watched the rest of the award show soaking wet. He was never cool, by the way.
No.
Yeah. Or the Labour Party. Yeah.
It's cold as ice.
So, so yeah, that was sort of the last incident that really read on, because honestly, after that, I think that was the culmination of the relevancy for Chumbawamba. But, you know, more of no, Tub Thumping did reach number 2 in the UK numbers, in the UK charts, number 6 in the US Billboard Hot 100, and number 1 in Australia, Canada, Ireland, Italy, and New Zealand. So it's a pretty big fucking song. I mean, I think culturally it's super relevant. I mean, it's again, I just talked about my 19-year-old daughter knowing what it was. You guys just fucking went ape shit when they played it. I claim to hate it, which I really do, but like, I know
you can't help it.
Right,
you hear
can't
it,
help
and
it.
You just,
yeah,
like, it's so
you
catchy.
Can't help it. Yeah.
It's so catchy. Like, I hate the Eagles with all of my heart and soul, but yeah, I still too. Know all the words to Hotel California, and I want to gouge myself in the eyeballs when I catch myself singing along to it. It makes me so mad. But it's so ingrained in our culture, and you've just heard it so many times. And I think that's what this song has done too.
Yeah. Because
I love Seven Bridges Road.
New boy in town, or is it a new kid in town?
No, Seven Bridges Road.
I know what you're saying. Don't invalidate my feelings, Ernie.
I'm a fan of harmony.
Harmony. Just head on down the road and loosen your load, man. Get out of here. I'm just kidding. You got the soundboards. Please stay.
There's
Baba Booey.
All right. Where's that mute button? Right there. Okay. Is there anything else to say, Amanda?
Actually.
Maybe next time she won't be rehired in 5 minutes.
But take it easy.
Oh, we're going to start doing puns now, huh? Well, I guess we're here for the long run.
Are we done?
We're done.
And that concludes Off the Rails episode number 4.
To be continued.
Yeah, Chumbawamba. That's what we were talking about.
Who?
So, funny, because I'm glad you said that, because recently when John Prescott, he kind of got back a little bit at them, when recently he, there was some sort of, and I remember just briefly reading this, but he was kind of asked about the incident, like, I don't know, 10, 20 years later. In 2012, when they dissolved, which we'll talk about next, he was asked, hey, Dake, how do you feel about Chumbawamba ending their career? He was a Chumba who? And yeah, that's kind of cool. I mean, come on.
I thought you were going to talk about like Roger Daltrey talking shit about Chumbawamba or something.
Was he? Did he?
No. I just thought maybe you found something that I didn't know.
Goddamn alternative facts. So I think, I mean, again, am I a fan of Chumbawamba? No. We'll go over kind of their split here in a second, but no, like, fuck no. No. Am I a fan of who they are as people? Yes, because that mirrors my existence. That mirrors my views. That mirrors how I feel about the world. That mirrors how I feel about the other side of the political spectrum. So, yeah, absolutely. Am I going to kind of have like Google notifications about what Chumbawamba and the members are doing? Fuck no.
Wouldn't be the first time.
But the music does nothing for me. Like, it just, it doesn't. That one album was great. I really, really, really loved it. I'm going to try to find it on vinyl. But other than that, nothing that they've done really musically has any impact on me. What do you think about? What did you hear? Like, what, from what you heard, how do you feel about Chumbawamba now that we've done this?
I kind of want to try to find some of that more obscure stuff and see what they were doing really, really early on. I want to pay a little bit more attention to the mid-career stuff too.
That's when they hit their stride.
Right. And maybe just focus on listening to the message they're saying and not really focus so much about the music. Cause it's really not like the sound that they were going for is not really my style, mm-hmm. but if I just want to hear more of what they have to say.
Right.
And it definitely makes me think of them more as like this party rock band, this jock jam anthem.
Which they're not.
They're not at all.
Yeah. I want to hear more vocals from this Alice
Nutter.
Yeah,
what an unfortunate last name, which isn't even hers. It's kind of like Ingeborg Humperdinck. Three episodes in a row and I brought that guy up.
How did you choose that name?
Nutter.
You know what? She's probably Alice Smith.
No, actually, Alice comes from Alice in Wonderland from Lewis Carroll. And the Nutter part, I read up on it. I did not memorize. The Nutter part comes from some other reference. And so that's not a real name. She chose those two names for reasons that I don't remember.
Yeah, I want to see what any of them are doing.
She's a fan of literature.
Yeah. So two of them have released albums. Nerd. I actually listened to Norbert's album. Which was way better than Chumbawamba's music in general. He released it a few years back. But again, way better. So memorable that I'm like, listen to it. That's all I can tell you. And it was so good. I mean, it was okay. I liked it.
I'm just curious about it.
But no, that's what I'm saying. But yeah, I don't know what they're doing in general. I didn't go that far.
I'm just more interested in hearing what they have to say. Politically than their actual musical quality.
I think one of the things that I truly admire out of everything and from all of them is that they never once apologized for anything. They never made reasons, like excuses for anything. Even Dub Dumping, they were like, fuck it,
punk.
We own it. Yeah, like
it is punk.
Like we get why we have the reputation that we have, but you don't know us. And we make no fucking apologies for
it. Right, and I love that. That's awesome. And they're just doing like, they stuck to their guns, even though they changed themselves musically. The core of what they were trying to do stayed consistent.
Right. So in 2012, so 10 years ago, they decided to end the project after 30 years of creating and destroying. They ended it without a tour. They just had a couple of shows, no press releases or anything else of real note. On their still accessible website, this chumba.com, I believe, they said that they felt that they've reached a point that as a band, the writing, recording, and touring cycles just weren't doing justice to what Chumbawamba stood for and, you know, in the first place originally. Just weren't doing it any justice anymore. They closed their goodbye letter, which is the only thing you can access on their website, with the following quote. Quote, "We do, of course, reserve the right to reemerge as Chumbawamba doing something else entirely. But frankly, that's not very likely. 30 years of being snotty, eclectic, funny, contrary, and just plain weird. What a privilege and what a good time we've had." End quote. I think that's great. I mean, if I were somebody who stirred the pot so much at the end of it, I could just be at peace and satisfied with what I've accomplished and done. Fuck yeah, that's what it's all about.
That's a great closing statement. Yeah. I mean, it's like, don't continue to do something if the project isn't
right.
Create. It's like, you know, the 80s sitcom when you know it was going downhill and they'd add the kid.
Right.
Like, don't do that. Like, just
like Married with Children. Yeah. But in further interviews, I did read that, you know, they still continue to create. They still continue to do things.
Good.
But yeah, that is the story of Chumbawamba and kind of why I think they're one of the hardest and most true anarchistic punk bands ever, even though they sound nothing like what we think of punk music.
So, should we talk about, have you done anything cool this?
Yeah, I know you did. So,
oh, yeah, yours is too. Longer.
Yeah,
mine's longer. And so you go first.
We went to see Jack White, last week or this week. Oh my God, please don't.
They can't see us.
No, the song. I went to see Jack White with Eric and my daughter Larissa, who actually, when I asked her, hey, do you want to go see Jack White? He's like, who's that? I said, do you want to go see the White Stripes? Yes!
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So this weekend, I had a really busy weekend, which I'm actually very happy that I have things to talk about other than painting my kitchen. I took the weekend off from work and had a vow renewal. My friends, Lori and Angie, they got remarried and their 20th anniversary. So we were able to go to that, and that was very lovely, their backyard. And then headed up Sunday morning, went up to Asheville to see Hai Long. Half of Charlotte was there. It was so great. They saw so many people. The show was amazing. There were topless Shield maidens. There were Ernest just perked up. They're a German band. Heilung means healing in German. They're more like Gaulish than Norse pagan, but they do follow the Norse pagan pantheon. So it was a lot of people in animal skins and bones and that kind of, but there's a beautiful stage show. It's just very like meditative and primal. Yeah, but the show was great. There was lots of fire involved. Saw a lot of great people from Charlotte that came up for the show. And I ended up hitting up a bunch of really great breweries. I went to Seven Clans, who's Cherokee owned.
All women owned too.
They got their they finally got their brick and mortar. This was their grand opening weekend. They're making really good beer. I just went there and threw a bunch of money at them.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have for today. I think this one ran a little longer than usual, but I think we're good. I actually like this episode. I mean, again, I fucking love going down that rabbit hole and you know, I wish.
It's always nice when Eric isn't here. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Pew, pew.
I'm kidding.
All right. Well, he'll be here soon.
Well, maybe. I don't know. He said he was taking. There you go. Up again.
Okay. We are out.
More
thank you.
More chair dancing.
A huge shout out to our gracious host, Tommy's Pub. Located at 3124 East Wade Drive, Tommy's Pub is a small neighborhood bar that's big on music and community. Go to Tommy's Pub's Facebook page where they regularly provide updates about upcoming events to include weekly open mic night, karaoke, and live music from some of the best up-and-coming bands in the Queen City. Thank you, Tommy's Pub, for hosting M-Vibes Podcast. We have a lot of interesting episodes coming up about music's most interesting topics. But we want to hear from you and what episodes you'd like to hear. If you have an idea for anything we should talk about, email us at mbuyspodcast@gmail.com. This episode was produced by BWM Productions and researched by Eric, Amanda, and Javier. If you like our podcast, please help us by rating and reviewing us on your favorite listening platform. And follow us on Instagram and Facebook at mbuyspodcast. Come on and join in the conversation.